She just knew for certain that they were going to live the rest of their lives together, that they were fated to meet, and that he was in love with her, but he was just in a kind of denial state, probably because of fear, because the passion that he felt was also intense. And she subsequently wrote him letters, stalked him, and it was such a really disturbing experience for him and his family that he left the country.
I'm Duarte Geraldino, in for Madeline Brand all week. Love drives some people to do crazy things. The woman you just heard about was in a stable marriage, but she fell in love with her dentist and then forced him to do some things that were even more extreme. But that's not even the strangest part of the story. Hear her story and find out about the psychology of love sickness. You've probably felt it yourself. But first, the Kavanaugh nomination is riveting. It seems like everyone watched at least some part of the hearing last Thursday with Christine Blasey Ford. Arizona Republican Senator Jeff Flake says, "This process is tearing our country apart." Polling this week suggests he may actually be right. Steve Shepard is campaigns editor and chief polling analyst at Politico. Hi, Steve.
Thanks for having me.
So what do the polls show about how Americans are reacting to Brett Kavanaugh and Christine Blasey Ford as people and public figures?
Well, first, I think you have to start with where Brett Kavanaugh was before these revelations were made. And to be honest, you know, when you compare him to past Supreme Court nominees, he wasn't terribly popular. I think a lot of Americans, particularly those who lean more Democratic, were nervous about the potential of President Trump's second pick for the high court changing the ideological composition of the court. There wasn't really a big rollout to generate a lot of positive press for him during the course of the summer in the run-up to his confirmation hearings, which were then very contentious. That said, you're right that a lot of Americans did watch or at least consume some sort of information about last week's hearings with Christine Blasey Ford. In our poll, it was nearly 60%, our Politico Morning Consult survey, who said that they watched at least some of the hearings or read about them afterward. More voters find Christine Blasey Ford to be credible than Brett Kavanaugh, though I would add that it is somewhat closely divided, and it is also pretty sharply divided along partisan lines. A Quinnipiac University poll out yesterday had 48% who said that they mostly believe Christine Blasey Ford, 41% said they mostly believe Brett Kavanaugh, but 84% of Republicans say they mostly believe Kavanaugh.
84%?
And 86% of Democrats say they mostly believe Christine Blasey Ford. So this partisan divide seems to be informing a lot of voters' impressions of these two individuals, let alone Kavanaugh's nomination to the court.
What about the process itself? Republicans are calling it a smear campaign. How are Americans, all of us, reacting to the way that this nomination is being handled?
Well, the only thing, the least popular institutions in American life over the past decade or so has been Congress. And so anything that Congress does is going to be, regardless of which party is in control, obviously Republicans have been in control of both chambers in Congress since the 2014 elections, is going to be viewed negatively. And we are seeing that, both in that Quinnipiac poll, both Senate Democrats, their approval rating for when it comes to handling the accusations against Kavanaugh, 38%, 52% disapprove. And then when you ask about Senate Republicans, the numbers are even worse. 33% approve, 56% disapprove. There's not a lot of goodwill for either party in Congress right now. So both
parties are taking a hit for this.
Both parties are taking a hit, and here's the thing. We don't know necessarily how this is all going to end up, how this is all going to work itself out. Mitch McConnell, the Senate Majority Leader, has vowed to hold the first test vote on Kavanaugh's confirmation by the end of the week. That's only 5 days away, so it could be in that time. That said, he does have a couple of members in his own conference who are uncomfortable with moving forward without additional information. That's why the FBI is reportedly questioning people who've been involved in this case. And, we'll see if what they come back from convinces McConnell to go ahead and have that vote by the end of the week.
Let's break that down a little bit, because you mentioned this discomfort that people are feeling right now. When you look at the numbers across the country in some specific areas, it becomes really interesting. Republicans feel that this nomination may end up actually helping them secure their Senate majority in the November midterms. What's the calculation there?
Well, so all those numbers that I've given you earlier, you know, in our poll, it's 37% who say Kavanaugh should be confirmed, 40% who say he shouldn't. In the Quinnipiac poll, it was a six-point gap. 42% said he should be confirmed, 48% said he shouldn't. You know, by and large, when you look at the national numbers, voters are split evenly, and at worst, voters tilt against confirming Brett Kavanaugh to the Supreme Court. Here's the catch. We are 5 weeks away today from 2018 midterm elections. In the Senate, because of the Senate elects six-year terms, which means only about a third of the seats in the Senate are up for election this year, and these are the seats that were last up in 2012, a good Democratic year, and you have a number of Democrats who are seeking re-election in states Donald Trump carried in 2016, 10 of them, 5 of whom are running in states that Donald Trump won by double digits. That means you have Democrats sitting in Senate seats like West Virginia, in states like West Virginia or North Dakota, Joe Manchin and Heidi Heitkamp respectively, while on the other side of the coin, there's only one Republican seeking re-election in a state that Hillary Clinton won in 2016, that's Dean Heller in Nevada. Republicans think even if Brett Kavanaugh's nomination to the Supreme Court is not very popular, just like President Trump is not very popular right now, because of the Senate map in this year's midterm elections, they think they can actually use this issue in a number of states to put Democratic senators on the hot seat, pressure them, punish them if they vote against Kavanaugh's nomination, and it could potentially help them in November. Now, that doesn't say anything about the House of Representatives, where all 435 seats are up every 2 years, and where the president's low approval ratings and Brett Kavanaugh's lack of popularity are likely to be anchors around the Republican Party this fall.
Steve, it's important to note what President Trump said today about Kavanaugh's nomination.
Well, I say that it's a very scary time for young men in America when you can be guilty of something that you may not be guilty of. This is a very, very difficult time.
There seems to be talk of a male backlash here in America. What's the gender divide in the polling on Kavanaugh?
Well, I'm looking right now at this Quinnipiac poll that came out yesterday. I mentioned 42% said that he should be confirmed, 48% say he shouldn't. Among men, 49% want him confirmed, only 40% say he shouldn't. When you ask among women, just 37% want him confirmed. A majority, 55%, say no. And if you then boil that down to white men, among white men, 59% of white men think Brett Kavanaugh should be confirmed to the court. Only 32% think that he shouldn't and don't want the Senate to confirm him. White women are split basically evenly on that question. It's clear that President Trump is speaking to his base, but he's also speaking pretty consistently with sentiments he's expressed during his brief political career. I'm not sure how much of the political calculation that is versus just a reaffirmation of the kinds of things he's talked about both on the campaign trail as a candidate and thus far as president.
Thank you so much. Steve Shepard is campaigns editor and chief polling analyst at Politico. Sex abuse and harassment are so common that even if it didn't happen to you, you likely know someone who is a survivor, even if that person hasn't told you yet. And sometimes the person is a man.
My father was raping me for 11 years of my life. I'm 64 years old now.
That was Joe McPherson. He shared his story with you. An estimated 1 in 6 men have been sexually assaulted or abused, but you likely don't hear from them. But Andrew Smiler hears from them every day. He's a therapist and expert on boys, men, and masculinity. He's also the co-author of the book, The Masculine Self. We spoke with Andrew earlier. Not to paint with a very broad brush, but how are the men and boys who survived sexual abuse talking about the Kavanaugh hearing?
And there's a couple of different reactions. There are a lot of guys, I would dare to say most guys, who continue to be pleased, seems like an odd word, but I think it's right, that we are hearing more and more survivors come forward to talk about their stories and in general get support for telling their stories. And at the same time, there are a number of male survivors who are really wondering, you know, when the guys are going to get their turn. Certainly Dr. Ford, who's come forward as female, and several other women who have come forward regarding Kavanaugh. The Me Too movement has largely been around women coming forward, and starting with Harvey Weinstein. But a lot of guys are wondering, okay, kind of when do we get to the next step? When do we start hearing men's stories and talking about men's stories of surviving sexual assault and rape?
We've had a couple of people on our show who are men and survived sexual assault, some subtle, some very graphic and disturbing, but all of it so equally bruising to their senses of self. How is it different, the conversations that these survivors are having with you versus women?
So I will give myself an out here in the beginning, which is that as a therapist, I only work with male clients. So I can't speak a whole lot to what the conversation is like with female survivors, at least not on the professional side. I certainly have female friends who've disclosed about their experiences to me. But a lot of the guys talk about shame, both shame at having been raped and also shame at having not been able to defend themselves, because we certainly teach boys and men that they should be able to defend themselves kind of in any situation. And I think that second piece is not nearly as present for women as it is for men.
There's this notion that the rape of men only happens in prisons or when they are children, based on the victims that you are counseling. How does that gel?
It's certainly a lot of what we see as therapists are occasionally teenage boys, but usually adult men reporting about events that happened to them, either as children or as teens. But we're also starting to get, or at least I'm starting to hear about a relatively younger group, a lot of guys, say, in their 20s, who are coming to therapy and reporting that essentially they've been roofied. They've been out at a party or at a bar drinking or whatever, and they've been drugged, only to, you know, come to later and discover that they've been raped. And that's a thing that when I started doing therapy 25 years ago, we didn't hear about.
So when do men feel ready to share their stories generally about abuse? What happens that triggers them to come forward?
There seems to be kind of two different pathways, if you will. A lot of the men who have been sexually assaulted or raped as children or as teens by an adult, they don't typically come forward until 20 or 30 years on. A lot of those guys go through their teens and even their 20s, never disclosing this to anyone, or maybe to the person they ultimately pair up with as a long-term partner. But then we seem to have, I kind of want to say the newer generation. I don't think that's quite right, but these young men who are getting roofied and whatnot and getting raped there, they seem to be more willing to come forward more quickly. So a lot of these younger men who are having these experiences as older teens or as young adults, they're coming in for therapy or they're being public and disclosing much more quickly. And in some ways, I think much more similar to their female peers than what we've historically seen.
We heard earlier how polls show a lot of men still support Brett Kavanaugh's nomination to the Supreme Court, and it explains why a lot of Republican lawmakers keep defending him over his accuser, Dr. Ford. But for male survivors of sexual abuse or assault, what messages does that send to them?
For male survivors, much like female survivors, the continued very public, very loud support for someone who's been accused of sexually assaulting multiple people is really invalidating. And we have certainly seen this before, both with female victims and with male victims. If we go back about 5 years now to the incidents regarding the Sayreville football team, when teenage boys were anally raping their teammates, those teammates who came forward had death threats, much like Dr. Blasey Ford has. If we go back to the first folks who came out and reported sexual abuse by priests, that's upwards of 20 years old now. Most of that initial group were adult men who had been sexually abused as boys, and they too were threatened and harassed and not believed in various ways. So I think kind of today, the male survivor community tending to support the victims who are coming forward and tending to feel in various ways assaulted and re-traumatized by the very public defense of Mr. Kavanaugh there.
What role can women play in encouraging men to come forward? And is that at all helpful to the cause? Or is it a separate cause that men have to have their own Me Too movement?
I think if we're talking at the level of just a one-on-one conversation, if a man in their life comes to a woman and says, look, this happened to me as well, then we really want the same kind of a response that they the ideal kind of response that they would give to anyone who would come to them. I think at the national level, the level of public conversation, I don't have a good answer. We watch the response to Dr. Blasey Ford and the other women who have come out reporting sexual assault by Mr. Kavanaugh, as we think back to some of the treatment of the women who came forward regarding Harvey Weinstein not that long ago. There is still a lot of pushback and a lot of folks who don't want to believe those women. So on one level, we need to make sure that victims are credible. And if that means women first and men waiting for their turn, perhaps politically, that's where we need to be. And at the same time, it would be nice if all victims had the space to come forward and could be believed.
Thank you so much for your insight and for the work that you're doing.
Sure. Thank you for having me. It's been a pleasure to be here.
Andrew Smiler is a licensed therapist and an expert on boys and men. Coming up, if California passes the rent control proposition on next month's ballot, I'm raising your rent. That's apparently what one landlord is telling people. Find out how the fight between landlords and renters here in LA is taking some strange twists. Next on Press Play.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Press Play, and I'm Duarte Geraldino, in for Madeline Brand all week. How much are you paying for rent? How much has it gone up in the last few years? Proposition 10 is on next month's ballot. If it passes, California cities and counties will be able to expand rent control. But this is really controversial. Landlords and renters are going at it over Proposition 10. Their fight is actually now taking a strange twist here in LA. Some landlords are apparently threatening to raise the rent if the rent control measure passes. Now, tenant activists say this amounts to voter intimidation. KCRW reporter Anna Scott's here with details. Anna, what a strange story.
Yeah, it's a little skirmish in this big fight that we're going to see play out over the next several weeks over Prop 10. So basically, this started late last week. A tenant from a building in the Hollywood area showed up at a tenant's rights clinic with this letter that was apparently from the property manager that runs her building. And they have several properties in LA. They're called Rampart Property Management. And it announced a $700 rent increase and said, I'm reading from the letter, which I have here, if the ballot initiative fails to pass because voters in California vote no to government control of apartments, we will revisit the rent increase with a desire to cancel it with new leases.
So what did the landlord want her to do?
Well, that's the question. Is this simply a letter sharing information about concerns over this ballot measure, or is this basically strong-arming tenants into trying to tell them to vote no on this proposition? Here's Larry Gross. He's the head of the Coalition for Economic Survival, which actually runs this clinic where this tenant showed up. He's the one that sent me this letter, and here's his take on it.
We see it as voter intimidation and extortion. Clearly, it's an attempt by this management company to get these tenants to vote against Proposition 10, vote against their self-interest.
And part of the problem with this letter is that it says in here, your property is non-rent control, but may become rent controlled as early as November 6th, 2018. Well, besides the fact that this gets the date of the election wrong, it says that the election is on November 5th. If this passes, there's not going to be a change overnight.
So clearly the letter had a couple of things wrong. But is this the case of one rogue landlord trying to influence the election, or is there something bigger here?
Well, that's also the other big question here. I've only seen a couple of examples of this. After this happened, over the weekend, I had an email exchange with an activist who's involved with the LA Tenants Union, Trinidad Ruiz, and he says he got a similar letter from his landlord, which he sent to me. It has very similar language in it, and it came along with a $75 rent increase, so not negligible. Here's Larry Gross talking about whether this is a coordinated effort or not.
You know, we have our suspicions. I mean, we've seen coordinated efforts like this in the past.
And he's referring to the fight there over Prop 13 in the 1970s, which limited property tax increases. And he says,
landlords did the same thing. They said to tenants that you better vote for this, otherwise you're going to get a rent increase. But if it passes, we'll reduce your rent. While Prop 13 passed, rents continued to go up.
Now, a spokesman for the campaign on no on Prop 10, Steve Maviglio, says this is definitely not a coordinated effort.
We think there are enough problems with Prop 10 for both homeowners and tenants that they don't need to go to this extreme that some people have, not something we've recommended.
However, he did say the campaign is encouraging landlords to talk to tenants about their concerns.
We're asking our property owners to inform their tenants of the consequences of what can happen under rent control.
And those consequences, he says, are things like apartments being taken off the market or turned into condominiums if cities go on to pass new rent control measures.
I keep on thinking about those movies where the villain says, if you don't do this, there will be consequences. Now, is this a situation where the landlord, the subtext is really, if this passes because you didn't vote, your rent is going to go up?
You know, I asked Steve Maviglio the same thing. I mean, it is hard to imagine a conversation between a landlord and a tenant where the landlord's saying, you know, hey, I'm just sharing my concerns, and there isn't some implication of, you know, if this passes, there will be consequences for you. Steve Maviglio says, you know, that's not the case. He says they're definitely not encouraging landlords to talk about it in a threatening way. Here he is again.
Certainly, just as there are very bad tenants, there are very bad landlords. And we want those who are dealing with their residents to be very factual with them, to urge them to go to our website to get the facts, to find out the truth about this.
So there you have it. He says they just want people to have these conversations. And, you know, we just have to take that at face value. And I think that anyone listening to this, if you've gotten a similar letter from your landlord, you know, to make your own decision, look at it with a critical eye, you know, go get the facts on the proposition. Keep listening to Press Play, because we're going to keep talking about this measure leading up to the election. We're going to do a lot more on it and do an explainer. So, you know, this is just a little taste, though, of some of the contentiousness around this ballot measure.
So what's the upshot here?
Yeah, I think this is just an indication of how important this measure is and how much fighting there is going to be over the next several weeks over it. You know, we have a housing crisis. We have a homelessness crisis in LA. So anything that has to do with rents, with housing production is going to be very passionately fought and get a lot of attention. A recent poll that I saw actually found Prop 10 down with about 16% of voters that were surveyed undecided. So there's going to be a lot of really heavy campaigning in the coming weeks, and you can listen to Press Play for some good straight-up analysis.
Looking forward to that, and obviously making sure people can find a place to call home. Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Anna Scott, reporter here for KCRW. Coming up, a married man courted thousands of prostitutes because he wanted them to fall in love with him. But here's the bizarre thing.
They would go and view houses together as potential purchases where they might live happily ever after. And at the point where the woman actually said to him, "I love you," was the point at which he disappeared.
Anything like that ever happened to you? Hear these true stories of people doing very strange things for love and the psychology behind it. That's next on Press Play. This is Press Play. Madeline Brand is away. I'm Duarte Geraldino. You can say what you want. I'm not walking out. Fuck all the rivers. Push, strike, and kill. I'm not gonna leave ya. There's no way I will. And I am telling you. We're talking about love, madness, the type of love that alters your chemistry, makes you have irrational thoughts, do strange things. You may not want to let anybody know if you've ever been on the giving or receiving end of this kind of love, but listen to this. Sometimes falling in love means literal madness. Like the woman who was convinced her dentist was secretly in love with her, she ended up driving him and his family out of the country. And then there was a man who squandered his giant fortune on 3,000 prostitutes. Both of them are Frank Tallis's patients. Dr. Tallis is a clinical psychologist. He writes about these patients and many others in his new book. It's called The Incurable Romantic and Other Tales of Madness and Desire. Dr. Tallis is here to talk to us about the biological and mental roots of lovesickness and what that could mean for all of us. Dr. Tallis, welcome to Press Play.
Hello.
So you write about this love sickness, and I always thought it was something people made fun of, but you're saying it's real.
Actually, it's a problem that has been recognized by doctors for probably about 1,000 years. It's only really since the maybe 18th, early 19th centuries that the idea of having a condition of longing and desire has lost currency. So it's something that's been recognized for a very long time indeed as a serious condition. So when one falls in healthy love, it's always been recognized that there's a degree of overlap with the symptoms of some mental illnesses. So deep melancholy, mood swings, obsession. However, when love goes wrong, the psychological consequences can be quite catastrophic. You know, you have infatuation, jealousy, heartbreak, inappropriate attachment, sex addiction, more seriously, stalking, murder, and suicide. So it's a very serious condition.
Are there biological changes that one can note? When we think of getting the flu, we think of that as a sickness. But love sickness, aside from the way I feel or the way I think about someone else, what, if any, are the biological evidence of this sickness?
Ancient doctors in classical times said that having an obsession about a loved one could actually disturb the chemistry of the body. And that's exactly what modern neuroscience has found. If you look at heartbreak, when people describe being in that kind of psychological pain, then the pain centers of the brain are activated. Chemicals that are like opiates are released when we fall in love. So it can be a little bit like a kind of morphine addiction. So there are lots of physical changes that underpin the experience of love, and particularly those that we associated with, if you like, the psychopathology of love.
When we think about love sickness, it's always a question of puppy love or someone who's just becoming an adult, this puberty love. But based on what I read in your book, this can happen at any age from 15 to 51 and beyond.
Absolutely. I mean, anybody can just simply fall in love in a pathological way. I suppose the best example of that is de Clairembaux syndrome, which is a sudden passion, usually for a stranger, and that individual may have not given the person affected any encouragement at all. The affected individual just falls in love, and it's like lightning out of a clear blue sky. And then they subsequently can make a terrible nuisance of themselves by stalking and trying to persuade the object of their affection that they're in a denial state and they're in love with them too. It's named after a psychiatrist, Gaetan de Clerambault, who wrote about this syndrome in the 1920s. But really he was, if you like, rediscovering a syndrome that had been described since classical times.
There was one story in particular of Megan. She was in her mid-40s, married for 20 years. She fell in love with her dentist, but it didn't turn out the way she wanted it, right?
Absolutely. And her dentist had given her no encouragement whatsoever. He was pretty much a stranger, and she fell in love with him. She attracted a diagnosis of de Clerambault syndrome because of the intensity of her passion. She felt attracted to him the first time she saw him, but after she had woken up from an anesthetic, after having a complicated extraction, she just knew for certain that they were going to live the rest of their lives together, that they were fated to meet, and that he was in love with her, but he was just in a kind of denial state, probably because of fear, because the passion that he felt was also intense. And she subsequently wrote him letters, stalked him, and it was such a really disturbing experience for him and his family that he left the country. It is a very, very sad condition and often has fairly tragic consequences for the individuals who are affected. I mean, this particular patient, you know, she had fallen in love. The object of her affection had gone from her life. And she thought that she could never find that kind of love again.
But she was married. I mean, she had a husband who she stayed
absolutely.
With.
Absolutely. She had been happily married for many, many years. And her and her husband were very well suited as partners. And they had never had any significant marital problems. It was just that, the love that she felt for her dentist was an extraordinary form of love, love at another level. I guess the way to think of de Clerambault syndrome is to think of all of our romantic ideals and amplify them unimaginably.
I mean, this is one of the things that so drew me to this book, because you have all these stories. In fact, there was that one about the rich guy. His name was, the name you gave him was Ali. Four kids, and he wasted his massive fortune, or rather spent it, on thousands of prostitutes, but he wasn't a sex addict.
No, he was a fascinating case. I mean, he was referred to me because his wife had discovered, as far as she knew, he had seen a prostitute, and his excuse was that he was under stress because he was working hard and he had a family business to run, which was very challenging. She said, well, look, you need to sort yourself out. And she said that that was a condition of her staying with him. He came to see me, and a few sessions in, we weren't really getting very far. And then he confessed that it wasn't just one prostitute he had seen, but 3,000 or thereabouts. He wasn't addicted to sex. He was addicted to the feeling of being fallen in love with. So he would pay for prostitutes or very high class escorts. He would then select maybe one who seemed to perhaps like him genuinely, and then he would start to court her. They would go and view houses together as potential purchases where they might live happily ever after. And at the point where the woman actually said to him, I love you, was the point at which he disappeared. He would just drop her from his life.
Are you still seeing him?
At the point where he confessed and I suddenly became very interested, he disappeared. He sort of replicated this pattern of behavior actually in the consulting room. And he was a private patient. and he never paid his bill. He just disappeared. So he did precisely what he did with his escorts and prostitutes with me.
Oh, my gosh. There was that story about Mark, one of the other patients that you write about, again, not his real name, where you show how narcissism is different from narcissistic personality disorder. How common is his condition?
His condition was a very rare condition, and it arose in a fairly complicated way. He was a gay man who had been brought up in a very anti-gay, homophobic environment at home. And he had, I suppose, internalized a lot of this homophobia. There was a part of him that couldn't accept being gay. And he had a very good relationship with a younger man, and it was working very well. But the younger man was a musician, and he was often going on tour, which left Mark a lot on his own. He would masturbate, he would stimulate himself, and he began to do this in front of a mirror. And eventually, this became his preferred sexual activity. And
masturbation or masturbation in front of the mirror?
Masturbation in front of the mirror became the main source of sexual satisfaction, which he would then ritualize, involving various fantasies, items of clothing, and so that it gradually extended and became a longer and more involved process. And it was as though, in the end, that he was just conditioning himself to respond sexually to his own image. In fact, the process itself, I mean, what he was actually doing, it isn't so remarkable that he conditioned himself. It was rather the sad way that he'd got to this place, which was through internalized homophobia and a feeling of self-disgust. Eventually, he just felt more comfortable being sexual on his own, and his perfectly satisfactory relationship broke up, which I, you know, thought was a very sad outcome, but it was his choice. And clinically, although I perhaps gave him alternative interpretations and suggested ways that he might sort of move forward, that was his choice. That's what he wanted to stay with.
Fascinating. You talk and write about these extreme cases. What does it tell us about individual folks who may not be so far on the spectrum, who are just somewhere in the middle? What can we take about your research?
You know, the lesson to take away from this is that, you know, we tend to treat mental illness and psychological problems as something that is very strange, remote, something that perhaps, you know, we don't think that we're vulnerable to. But I guess what the case series I describe suggests is that the intensity of the experience of love is a common and universal vulnerability, that none of us are exempt from psychological problems. And this perhaps is the most common pathway to forms of emotional instability. I suppose what I would hope, there's a sort of a public information aspect of my book, which is that people will read it and, you know, think and reflect about their own mental health and reflect on how, you know, love and passion are universals that can have consequences that are very distressing.
Listening to you makes me think about some of the day-to-day activities that it seems like everyone is engaging on. You know, you've looked up your ex on Google and social media. So, Dr. Tallis, are we all stalkers to some degree?
Well, that is a very interesting question. And Googling ex-lovers, checking up on Facebook, Twitter accounts, all those kinds of things are obviously a relatively new phenomenon, but they tell us something very interesting about the human condition. I mean, not so long ago, if you engaged in any form of stalking, you know, you would attract some kind of psychiatric diagnosis. You would be regarded as someone who was, you know, perhaps quite sinister or a threat. Now, what social media has demonstrated is that given the slightest chance, and we all become stalkers, I mean, it's a universal thing. It just goes to show, you know, that something that appears to be so sinister, so threatening, is something that we're all capable of doing, at least at some level.
Thank you so much for chatting with us.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Dr. Frank Tallis is the author of The Incurable Romantic and Other Tales of Madness and Desire. And what's next for the Dodgers now that they've clinched the National League West? Find out next on Press Play. This is Press Play. I'm Duarte Geraldino, in for Madeline Brand all week. It was a long slog of a regular season, but the Dodgers did it. They won the National League West for the sixth straight year. It was a tie-breaking win against the Colorado Rockies yesterday, and Los Doyers clinched their division. So what's next for the Blue Crew? Scott Andes has some clues. He's the owner and editor of the LA Dodger Report. Hey, Scott.
Hi, Duarte. Thanks for having me on. How are you?
I'm doing well now that we got this victory. So rookie Walker Buehler pitched for nearly seven innings yesterday. He pretty much shut the Rockies down from the mound until the sixth inning. Should he take most of the credit for the win?
Well, probably yes, but you know, obviously it's a team effort, and it's been a team effort for them over the last several weeks during the stretch drive. But I think that they stood a much better chance to win, of course, with Buehler on the mound. You know, he was just fantastic, and what strikes me the most about him is he's such a fiery competitor.
Fiery. You know, Clayton Kershaw says he's pretty cocky.
Yeah. And it's that attitude, and it comes out in the way that he pitches, because, you know, when things don't go his way, he's upset. And, you know, he doesn't like that. That's the kind of drive that you want, especially in the postseason and in big game situations. You know, you want that arrogant, fiery attitude. Even during the game, you know, he only struck out three batters. You know, he didn't have like his best swing and miss stuff, but he was still able to, you know, mix his pitches well, and he got the guys out regardless. He's been their best pitcher all year long.
So what about the two Dodgers who hit home runs?
Cody Bellinger, you know, he struggled a little bit during the middle of the season, and, you know, the Dodgers were kind of just tinkering with his swing a little bit, tinkering with his batting stance. But it looks like he finally kind of figured it out. You know, he's got a really a long swing, and it seems like he covers a lot of the plate. But, you know, Bellinger's a talented player, and normally, you know, talented players will find ways to make adjustments, because it's all about really adjustments, making adjustments. And sometimes the league will adjust to you, and they pitch you differently. And I think also that kind of went into play after his amazing rookie year last year. You know, the word was out on him. So opposing pitchers kind of changed their approach a little bit to him, and then Bellinger had to change his approach. And, you know, his home run yesterday, it was huge.
It was pretty remarkable. I remember watching it. By the way, you speak about pitching, and it's been a big issue for the Dodgers. Clayton Kershaw hasn't been his usual dominant self. Now, he's supposed to pitch in Game 1 against the Braves on Thursday. What do you expect from him?
With Kershaw, the thing about Kershaw is, number one, there's age. You know, age is creeping up on him. Ooh. You know, he's already, you know, 30, 31 years old. He's been pitching for 10 years. I mean, we're talking about, this is a sixth consecutive postseason run on him. He's had chronic back problems over the last couple of years. And, you know, the innings pile up. You know, hey, Father Time catches up with everybody, even the greatest of players. So with Kershaw, his fastball just isn't what it used to be. You know, he's lost about 4 or 5 miles an hour on it. So, and Kershaw is a fastball, curveball, slider guy. That's, you know, obviously we know he's got that great curveball, and it's like public enemy number one. But, you know, with Kershaw, if he doesn't have that extra velocity on his fastball, then he's got to rely primarily on his curve and slider. And now he's really kind of has to change the way that he pitches, because if his command isn't precise, and for him, a lot of it's going to be about location and keeping the ball down and, you know, trying to prevent home runs. And I've noticed, like, a lot of the times he's still trying to come after hitters with the fastball, and he just doesn't have that anymore, or at least this year. So for him, you know, it's going to kind of be more relying on off-speed stuff, relying more on control, maybe even being, you know, a little bit more of a finesse pitcher. And I think that we're seeing Kershaw trying to adjust more into that type of pitching, you know, since he can't just blow guys away anymore, it seems. So I think that the Dodgers are really going to have to watch him now. They're going to have to watch him carefully in his starts.
Well, it seems, you know, like we're all watching him. Hey, I want to make sure to ask you something, because I'm noticing a lot on the field. It seems like the Dodgers have a different lineup every day, which is kind of uncommon. What's their best bet of a lineup against the Braves?
Well, what the Dodgers have been doing is, you know, they have a lineup against left-handed pitchers, and then it's another lineup against right-handed pitchers. And they do this based on matchups and analytics. There are certain guys that hit better against lefties and certain guys that hit better against righties. And they like that versatility, and they like to mix and match. For me, and this has been my opinion, I think that the best hitters should play. You know, the best hitters should play. I mean, Bellinger, Muncy, Puig, they should all be in the lineup every day, I think. But my lineup would be Bellinger in center, Puig in right. I like Kemp in left, Muncy
Kemp
in first.
Left? Muncy in first? Wow.
I like Kike at second base. And, of course, you got Machado at short, Turner in third, and then Grandal behind the plate. You know, Kemp hasn't really been hitting a whole lot in the second half, but he's been so good with runners on base. I think at least against right-handers, he will probably get a good amount of the playing time. But, you know, we'll see. A lot of it depends on matchups.
Yeah, so much depends. I'll be watching. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Duarte.
Scott Andes is the owner and editor of the LA Dodger Report. And now Christian Bordal is here to talk to us about some feedback we're getting.
Yes, hey, Duarte. So you talked earlier about mad love, the kind of craziness that can happen when we fall heavily, deeply for someone. Monica Palacio says, I became a vegetarian for a dame. We're not together anymore, but I'm still a vegetarian. Cathartic Cacophony writes, I fall in love too easily. So I ran a little Twitter poll. I said, how many times have you been deeply, madly in love in your life? Militant Angelina responded, does this include unrequited love or mutual relationships only, asking for a friend? Mm. 14% said it hasn't happened to me yet.
What?
They're still waiting to fall madly and deeply for the first time. 61% said one or two times they've been madly or deeply in love. 21% said 3 to 5 times. And 4% said, I've lost count.
I've lost count. I mean, love is in the air. I'm meeting a friend later this evening who just got engaged, so I know that true love is possible.
And it's waiting for you.
We'll see, although I have a buddy who said once, oh, I caught a relationship as if it was a cold. So there is some truth to that.
Uh-huh.
Thank you so much. This is Press Play, and I'm Duarte Geraldino in for Madeline Brand all week. Join us again tomorrow.